The views and opinions expressed by the following program are those of the host, guest, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station or the Webster Rock Hill Ministries, its management, or other host or underwriting sponsors. Programs presented on KWRHLP are for educational and entertainment purposes only. Views which are presented are for educational purposes only and are not intended to treat, diagnose, or claim any cure of disease or condition.
Welcome to Webster Groves Health Radio. I'm your host, Matt Factor, from Factor Physical Therapy. That's located in Webster Groves at the corner of Watson McLeod Station Road in Yorkshire Village. And I'm here with my co-host, David Factor. On Webster Groves Health Radio, we discuss health-related issues along with improving our community. For today's show, we invited on Dr. Michael Twyman, who is a cardiologist at St. Louis Heart and Vascular Cardiology. Welcome to the show, Dr. Twyman.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, Dr. Twyman. So in part one, we were talking about cardiac catheterization, and we were talking about the advantages between the radial artery approach and the femoral artery approach. And I just kind of wanted to go back over that again and figure out which one you thought was the best and why.
They're both good procedures. I can do both of them. I trained down at St. Louis University, and in 2009, the radial artery approach was starting to become more popular. The benefits of the radial artery approach is there's less bleeding risk for the patient, and there's a faster recovery. The radial artery is the artery that's right on your wrist when you take your pulse. That area is very easy to put a catheter into and do the procedure, and there's much less risk of bleeding afterwards because you can visualize the area and hold pressure if there's any issues with bleeding.
So cancer, it seems to be very prevalent nowadays. Are there any particular treatments for cancer that can harm your heart?
There definitely are, and it can be either chemotherapy or radiation therapy can damage the heart. Typically, breast cancer is one of the ones that tends to have a lot of risk for cardiac involvement. If the radiation is directly over the left side of the chest, the coronary arteries that sit on the outside of the heart, they're getting irradiated as well, and that radiation can damage the arteries. So patients who have certain types of cancers have more risk of getting what's known as a cardiomyopathy or weakened heart from the therapies. So many times they'll get an echo and ultrasound before the chemo or the radiation and then during the treatment to make sure that the heart is doing okay.
Can they re-strengthen it after that through exercise, or does it just stay permanently damaged?
It tends to be there's medications that can help block certain hormones that affect the heart. And many times once the chemo and the radiation are completed, the heart function may improve.
Okay, so it's not perfect yet.
Not perfect yet.
So can you prevent or reverse heart disease by a diet or any other means?
It's a good question. The first question always is, do you have the disease in the first place? So If you have the disease, then you can work on reversing it. And there are things you can do in your lifestyle that can help. The bigger question is it all a nutrition story? And it probably is not. It's multifactorial. You know, it's how well you sleep, how well you move, how well you deal with stress.
Interesting. So should we be really concerned about, let's say you wanted to be proactive. Should I go out and just try to do, I don't know, start purchasing books on heart healthy diets and all this stuff? You know, Oprah had a guest, or, you know, should I start changing my whole life around because I'm afraid of having to see somebody like you someday? Or,
well, I hope you're not afraid to see me for prevention parts. I mean, that's the goal is, you know, he asked me earlier, you know, who should see a cardiologist? And most people always figure they should see a cardiologist if they're having a problem. Uh-huh. But my goal is to prevent people from ever having that problem in the first place. So I'm more than happy to see people that have no symptoms to begin with. But back to the diet question, you know, there's 200, 300 diet books a year that get put out. If one of them was a perfect diet, everybody would already be doing that diet. So there's no perfect diet for each individual. It's very specific to, you know, what your current environment is.
So then you should meet with your cardiologist and you can go over those?
Your cardiologist or your primary care physician, you can work with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like, you know, in my quest to always be healthier, I've come across a lot of different books. One of them by Dr. Campbell called The China Study, or Dr. Esselstyn's book, Prevent Reverse Heart Disease, or the work of Dr. Ornish. And I was just wondering kind of, you know, your take on you know, those type of approaches?
So I'm fairly familiar with the Dr. Dean Ornish's intensive cardiac rehab program. I don't currently, you know, run a cardiac rehab program, but I've done some research about it, and I've seen Dr. Ornish speak at some conferences. I think one challenge with the Dr. Ornish's plan is that it's not really all about a low-fat diet, you know, reversing the atherosclerosis of the heart disease. It's that the patients had social support, they did mindfulness, they had, you know, scheduled exercise. So there was, it was, again, a multifactorial thing that probably led to a lot of the plaque regression that they were getting in their studies.
So you mentioned it. What is cardiac rehabilitation?
Cardiac rehabilitation is generally done after you've had some type of major cardiovascular event. So you've had a heart attack, you've had bypass surgery, you've had one of your valves replaced, you've had stents, you have congestive heart failure where your heart isn't pumping well. There's many things that are covered by insurance for cardiac rehab, but cardiac rehab is essentially monitored exercise. You know, you meet with a nutritionist, you may or may not meet with, you know, a stress relieving counselor, you know, those type of things. And then you have the group effect where you get to do this with other people who have similar issues and, you know, can be motivated by the group.
You get a support system.
Correct.
So what is, I've done a little bit of reading and I've seen some articles where they're saying that there's like, some controversy around using cardiac stents. And I guess there were some articles that had come out in some different, scholarly publications, and they had kind of shown that maybe the medication therapy was more important than the stent, but then maybe the stents were showing some pain relief. And I was kind of curious, it's not every day do I get to ask a cardiologist, you know, what do they think and what's the prevailing, you know, opinion?
No, it's a very good question, and it's not always black and white. Every person's an individual, and you have to look at their story as it goes. But I think that the study you're probably referring to is the COURAGE trial. And it doesn't show that medications are better than stents or that stents, you know, are better than medicine. It's just that medicine therapy is very effective. The stents are also very effective at relieving symptoms for patients who are not actively having a heart attack. But stents do definitely have their role. They're a tool that you can use. But patients do need to realize that stents aren't permanent fixes. You know, they fix the problem that happened, but they don't fix why you got it in the first place. And if you don't change something in your environment, you're very likely to keep developing more and more plaque.
So what is the stent and what is it doing for the patient?
So a stent is basically a metal scaffolding that is able to push the plaque out of the lumen where the blood flows and restore blood flow downstream. So a stent just helps hold the artery open and blocks the plaque from occluding the lumen where the blood was flowing.
Is it unrealistic to say, what if you put a stent through all of everybody's arteries, would they be impervious to any type of heart attack?
No, I don't think so. And stents are not risk-free on that component because the stent is a metal tube. Your body has to heal in that metal tube. And until it does that, there's a risk a blood clot could form inside the stent. So you typically have to take aspirin and another antiplatelet agent to prevent clots from forming inside the stent. There's risk that the stents over time, you know, you'll make more scar tissue inside the stent and the stent will close up. So if you put, you know, what's called a full metal jacket in all their arteries, then, you know, you won't be really able to bypass them later if you needed to, and you would have to keep trying to work inside stents, and it gets harder and harder the more you keep working inside the same stent.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so you usually don't take a child to like a cardiologist unless they have some sort of event that would bring them to it. Like as you age, at what age do you usually recommend people start going to their cardiologist for like preventative?
I would say first start with your, you know, primary care doctor and, you know, do the basics. You know, are you at an optimal weight for your height? You know, what is your current exercise regimen? What are you currently eating? You know, how are you dealing with stress? But if you have a strong family history, you know, you had mom, dad, somebody had a heart attack in their 40s and 50s, you have, you know, some other risk factors, really high cholesterol, diabetes, high blood pressure, you know, you may want to do a little bit more testing because, you know, just looking at high blood pressure, diabetes, cholesterol, if you smoke or are obese, isn't going to get the about 400 things that have now been discovered that can cause coronary atherosclerosis. So generally start with your primary care doctor, but if you have a strong family history, you may want to go for that calcium score see a preventive cardiologist.
Interesting. And then once somebody does see a cardiologist and have this workup, let's say that you gave them a clean bill of health, should they follow up in 5 years or should they follow up every year? Is it like the dentist? Maybe you should come more often.
That's a good question. If your calcium score is zero, you truly are low risk. The data right now says that you probably should repeat that test in 5 years. So if your score is zero, I tend to have patients go back, follow up with their primary care doctors. If you know their score is greater than 100 or so, they may need to check in at least once a year, make sure everything's doing okay, maybe doing some more of that advanced lipid testing.
So when a patient does go to the cardiologist, what should they expect of their visit?
Generally depends on why they're going to see the cardiologist, but typically they may do an EKG to look at the baseline electrical activity of your heart, and they'll check your blood pressure. Then they will interview you to see what kind of current symptoms you're having, what heart testing you've done in the past. They'll tend to do a physical exam, head to toe, looking at your blood vessel intensity, listen to your heart, listen to your lungs, then come up with a plan, you know, if there's further testing that's required.
I like that you mentioned the lungs. Can you kind of explain to the listeners the connection between the lungs and the heart?
Sure. So the lungs are the area of the body that oxygenates your blood. So if the heart's pumping the blood around, the blood goes out of the left side of the heart, goes around the system to your muscles, comes back through your vein system to the right side of the heart. The right side of the heart then pumps that blood to the lungs. The lungs give it the oxygen. The blood then goes to the left side of the heart and keeps repeating that cycle.
Yeah. So as we age, so what are some different heart issues that become more prevalent?
Age is always generally the number one risk factor for majority of cardiovascular diseases. You just wear and tear the parts. So one of the more common disorders other than atherosclerosis is you start developing valve disease, the aortic valve in particular. The aortic valve is the valve that lets blood flow out of the heart each time it squeezes. It's more common that the valve will calcify and get thickened over time as you age. That can get picked up on physical exam, somebody listening to your chest and hearing the blood kind of whoosh through that valve. I tell people it sounds sort of like your finger over a garden hose, that sound. Or somebody's getting an echocardiogram, the ultrasound of the heart for another reason, it would be able to see the structure of the valves.
Is that the same as a murmur, or is that different?
The murmur is just the abnormal flow across some cardiac structure, and you're just hearing that flow with a stethoscope.
Okay.
So I just wanted to remind our listeners they are listening to Webster Groves Health Radio on KWRH LP with Matt Factor and David Factor of Factor Physical Therapy. And our guest is Dr. Michael Twyman, who is a cardiologist at St. Louis Heart and Vascular Cardiology.
So I wanted to ask you what type of heart diseases or issues should our listeners be concerned about it, but it really kind of sounds like it's not a simple answer. Everybody's different.
That's correct. You know, everybody is an individual. You're an N of one. So, you know, an N of one means that, you know, in an experiment, there's one person. So, you know, people sometimes will ask, you know, what is the risk of this procedure? And you can say it's a couple percent points that something, you know, bad might happen. But if it happens to you, it's 100%. Right. So everybody's an individual and you have to look at their full story to come up with a plan for them.
So with spring coming up, are there any heart issues that increase during this type of year?
Not generally. Maybe people are getting a little bit more active and, you know, now that the weather's getting a little bit nicer, but it's not that uncommon that we see that, you know, people who have, you know, peripheral arterial disease or coronary disease, if they get one of them fixed, they start getting more active. The other area starts acting up, and then you have to go kind of fix that area.
Interesting. So as a cardiologist, do you do a lot of the cardiac surgeries as well, or is that a different specialist?
It's generally a different specialist. So there's cardiovascular specialists such as myself that focus on, you know, doing procedures that are in the office, but there are also cath lab based ones where that's the radio artery cath. There's procedures where you're looking at the heart valves using special echocardiography equipment that the patient swallows, but not doing the open heart surgery, not changing the valves out ourselves. There is a procedure called a TAVR, which is a way to install a new aortic valve over a catheter-based system. So many times that's done in assistance with the cardiac surgeon. So the cardiac surgeons are the ones doing the major heart transplants, the bypass surgery, the valve replacements for the most part.
So what are some things that our listeners can do, or what are the ways that you can protect and take care of your health and your cardiovascular system?
So the first thing is to look at your local environment. You know, how well are you sleeping? I think that's probably the number one question people should be asking themselves. If they're sleeping optimally, then they can repair the damage that they've done throughout the day. Then, you know, how are they able to move? You know, it's not saying everybody needs to be, you know, super fit, but, you know, if they can't walk upstairs without being short of breath or severely fatigued, then they're very deconditioned. You know, nutrition is important. You know, I don't have a specific diet for everybody. You can't say low-fat, high-carb, high-carb, low-fat is right for every single person. You have to look at them as an individual and look at their biomarkers and what their goals are. So
even if I copied your diet, I might not succeed.
That's correct. It actually all comes down to your mitochondria. So.
Yeah, so interesting. So you talked about it's really important to sleep because it repairs the damage throughout the day. Are you talking about the damage in the heart muscles, because the heart's just a muscle also, and so it's been working all day? Or
generally not necessarily the heart muscle per se, but more the your skeletal muscle and the damage that you've done in the gym. So, you know, when you go work out, you lift weights, you know, you're tearing down the muscle proteins. You know, the time that you actually build more muscle is when you're recovering, and that's when you're sleeping.
Interesting.
All right.
So it's interesting. We talked earlier, I guess it was probably in part one, we talked a little bit about cholesterol. And I know for a long time the prevailing thought was if you eat a bunch of cholesterol, you'll have high cholesterol. Can you kind of explain that?
That was definitely the thought for many years, but that's turning out to not really be so true. Your body produces probably 3/4 of the cholesterol that your body uses. So if you, you know, go on a 0%, you know, cholesterol diet, your body will just make what it needs. So eating dietary cholesterol really isn't the problem. It's when that dietary cholesterol gets oxidized or damaged from something else you're doing in your environment, that's when the problem comes in.
So basically people can have all the McDonald's they want and don't have to worry about it?
That's not what I said. It's more the, you know, they get concerned about the cholesterol and shrimp per se, or cholesterol and eggs. So that's more the issue. It's more, you know.
Diet still matters, but you don't have to go ahead and just watch all the cholesterol values very closely on the food you're eating.
Correct. I mean, if you focus on a whole foods, minimally processed type diet, you don't have to be so concerned about the dietary intake of cholesterol.
Okay.
So does high cholesterol cause heart attacks?
Yes and no. There are rare cases where people will have what's known as familial hyperlipidemia, where they'll have extremely high cholesterol levels. Many of these people can have heart attacks in their 20s and 30s. But that, again, is one of the things that high cholesterol is getting oxidized or damaged, and they're laying down plaque because of that. There's also people that have very high cholesterols as they age. They have calcium scores of 0. They're not as high risk. So cholesterol by itself isn't the be-all, end-all of heart disease.
So what about saturated fat? Is that a problem?
Generally not a major problem.
Okay. So then you don't have to worry about avoiding it.
Right. I mean, and again, that's one of those areas that is, you know, the data's not so black and white. You know, there's studies that can show saturated fats cause heart disease. There's studies that show that it doesn't cause it. I think as long as you're focusing on the quality of the food, it's not as important to be looking at the saturated fat content as a problem.
What about like oils that we cook with or eat? Or is there a particular one that's better than another one?
It's a good question. Typically, the olive oil, coconut oil, the ones that are less inflammatory. You know, so I don't tend to recommend, you know, corn oil, soybean oil. Those ones tend to be more pro-inflammatory, meaning the arteries are likely to be more damaged by those long term. There's something called the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio that you can check on blood work that tells you, are you getting too much of the more pro-inflammatory oils? Are you getting enough of the anti-inflammatory omega-3 oils?
Is it possible? So in my previous life, I worked as a firefighter, and so something that a lot of firefighters dealt with was a lot of heart disease. Do you think that is linked to the stress of the job, or is it because every time the alarm goes off, everybody's heart goes from 0 to, you know, 200 beats per minute and all that? Is that harming us, or is that making them fit?
No, that's a very good question. You know, as I was talking offline, you know, my father and brother are both, you know, firemen, and, you know, I'm acutely aware of the health effects that the fire service places on them. It's not that uncommon that, you know, firefighters, you know, have an event, you know, in the line of duty because of the stressors that are going on their body. So there's obviously the physical stressors of running into a burning building with all your gear on. There's the heat stress. There's the whatever's burning in the building you're breathing in. You know, that all puts a tremendous stress and strain on your cardiovascular system. So yes, heart disease is not necessarily more common in firefighters, but it tends to show up about 10 years earlier than in the general public.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting too what you said earlier about sleep pain playing a big role, because that's really something I wouldn't have thought a lot about initially. It plays a big role in a lot of other health things, but I wouldn't have thought about how it related to my heart. And I know when I was a fireman, we were constantly, the alarm was going off at night, so our sleep was constantly being interrupted. So I know that probably played a role.
That's definitely probably one of the leading roles of why, you know, firefighters are developing heart disease at an earlier age, is that interrupted sleep and the, like you said, you know, the 0 to 100 type of stuff. You know, your adrenaline level just, you know, goes through the roof.
Yeah.
So how can you determine if you're having, or identify if you're having, a heart attack? And do men and women, would they identify differently?
It's a good question, and it's one that, you know, it's sometimes hard to give a complete answer to, but, you know, if you're having the classical elephant sitting on your chest, that's pretty, you know, common sense that you need to go get that checked out. But men and women can present differently. Again, it's maybe as simple as they just feel fatigued. They may have some tingling in their arm. They may be just more short of breath when they're going up the stairs. They may not have that classic, you know, grabbing your chest, somebody stepping on your chest sensation. So really listen to your body. Most of the time, you know, if it's something that you're physically stressing, so you're exercising, it comes on, or you're under a lot of emotional stress, you're having a disagreement, you're, you know, really worried about something and the symptoms come on, the physical and emotional stress can drive the symptoms. So take a look at your body, and if you're having those symptoms with it, that may be a sign of a heart attack. Typically, heart attacks, you know, the discomfort is going to persist and isn't going to go away quickly. So if it's lasting for more than a couple minutes, you need to go get that checked out.
So once a heart attack has occurred and you go to the hospital and it's already stopped, can you guys identify that a heart attack did occur?
So there's typically three things you look at to say, is this likely a heart attack? One is the story, what's going on, you know, what are their symptoms? Then the second one is looking at their electrocardiogram. If their electrocardiogram shows that there's evidence of a heart attack, either old or an acute. And then there's blood markers, something generally called troponin, which is a protein inside heart muscle cells. Typically, you don't see that in your blood system. So tell people that if there's troponin in their blood, it means that the heart cells had died and released that protein into their system. And that's a marker. How high it is how big the heart attack is.
Do diabetics have a higher risk of heart problems?
They tend to, because the diabetes is very pro-inflammatory and their arteries are likely to be damaged because of that inflammation. The diabetics also have mitochondria that generally aren't as functional, and that's a risk factor for heart disease.
So do vitamins and supplements, do they lower the risk of heart disease?
That's a little bit of a loaded question, because it depends on what nutrient or supplement you're really speaking of. There are certain targeted supplements that can stabilize plaques, but, you know, a blanket statement of all supplements can reduce heart disease isn't so so good. But, you know, I typically will work with patients that, you know, certain medications may not be tolerated, and there are some supplements that can be used for those patients.
Do you know if they're as effective, or is it quite a downgrade to not be able to take the medication with the side effects?
Depends on what the issue truly is, but, you know, there's, you know, supplements and pills and procedures aren't nearly as effective as doing the lifestyle changes. So, you know, if somebody can't take a certain medicine because of a side effect, well, if they can get optimal sleep, they can get, you know, optimal water, optimal nutrition, and get some physical activity, that's going to be much more important than that they can tolerate one or two medicines.
So what would be one daily activity that someone could do today that would make their heart healthier?
Go outside, get some sunlight, get some activity.
All right. That sounds good. How can our listeners get in touch with you or your office to set up an appointment?
Sure. I work at a couple offices in the St. Louis area. The phone number is the same, 314-741-0911, St. Louis Heart and Vascular. I see patients in the office Monday through Friday.
All right. Sounds great.
Thank you for coming.
Yeah. Sure, thank you. I would like to thank Dr. Michael Twyman, who's a cardiologist at St. Louis Heart and Vascular Cardiology, and for coming and talking with us about his practice. And we'd like to thank our listeners for joining us for Webster Groves Health Radio. Join us for upcoming shows on Wednesdays at 9:30 a.m. and Thursdays at 2:30 p.m.